Well, it was so much fun following all these wonderful presentations of people who are actually out there in the community. And I was debating whether I was going to admit this right up front, but I think I will. I'm just going to talk about numbers. But I think at some point it is important to get some statistical information. So I'm going to talk about pregnancy and women with disabilities. And my colleague Amy Wind is here in the audience. And I want to thank Amy for helping with these slides and with the project. No disclosures. Okay, there's kind of anecdotal sense that about 1 million women of childbearing age in the United States have some form of disability, and physical disabilities are considered to be the most common. The numbers are likely to grow in coming years for a variety of reasons. First of all, women who were born or in early life acquire what were previously life-threatening disabilities are now living into young adulthood and middle age and even early older age. And also, frankly, the obesity epidemic. Obesity, according to the epidemiologist, doesn't necessarily kill people, but what it does do is contribute to early disability. So numbers will increase in coming years. There's not much information about the reproductive choices and experiences of U.S. women with chronic physical disabilities, although there have been a series of growing series, actually of kind of small qualitative studies talking about the stigmatization, the kind of outright hostility that sometimes women with physical disabilities confront, not only, frankly, from the medical community, but also from friends and family and strangers on the street. But little is known about how often this happens. How often do women with physical disabilities actually get pregnant? So our purpose is to use the National Health Interview Survey, which is a survey, a nationally representative survey of non-institutionalized civilians in the United States, to produce basically the first nationally representative numbers of women with chronic physical disabilities who are currently pregnant. And our chronic physical disability definition is from a self-report. So three research questions. What is the annual national prevalence of current pregnancy for U.S. women with chronic physical disabilities? How do sociodemographic characteristics relate to current pregnancy? And after controlling for sociodemographic attributes, what is the association of chronic physical disability with current pregnancy? Methods. Our data set, we had to combine across years from the National Health Interview Survey because the numbers are pretty small for pregnancy and women with physical disabilities. But the sample adult core of the NHIS, the National Health Interview Survey, which is randomly administered to one randomly selected sampled adult from the families that are selected for the NHIS, ask women ages 18 to 49 if they are currently pregnant. That's the only question about pregnancy in the entire survey. So we have no idea what happens after they say they're currently pregnant, but we know at least their self-report that they are currently pregnant. And the sample adult core actually has pretty good response rates. Just as an example from 2011, about 82% conditional response rate. Right, so our study sample, again across 2006 to 2011, started out looking at the 18 to 49-year-old women, 47,900 or so people. We eliminated about 0.2% of women who did not respond to the current pregnancy question. We eliminated 0.3% of the sample because they didn't respond to any of the mobility difficulty questions we used. And we eliminated 7 women with Alzheimer's disease. Our final initial sample, therefore, was 47,629 women. And of that, 0.6% gave proxy responses. All right, so our chronic physical disability indicator comes from something that the National Center for Health Statistics analysts produced. We started there. It dealt with 8 movement difficulty questions from the NHIS, which were walking quarter mile, climbing 10 stairs, standing for 2 hours, sitting for 2 hours, stooping, bending, or kneeling, reaching overhead, using fingers to grasp small objects, or lifting or carrying a 10-pound item. And we looked only at women who self-reported that these functions were somewhat difficult or more difficult than that. We initially identified 6,766 women through this indicator, but we eliminated 138 women, 2%, who reported that the cause of their disability, of these functional deficits, was pregnancy. Respondents were actually instructed by the NHIS questionnaires not to give any responses relating to pregnancy, but these 138 women did. And so we eliminated them from the currently pregnant group with disabilities. We then eliminated about 4% of women who said that their cause was not a physical health problem. And again, the NHIS asks, after they ask the functional deficit questions, what is the cause? They got about 35 different causes, and some women indicated that it was a behavioral problem, or mental retardation is actually used in the NHIS as the category instead of intellectual disabilities or other cognitive problems, and so we eliminated them. We then eliminated about 5% of women who said that the cause was not a chronic condition. And so finally, out of our sample, we had about 6,000 women who had chronic physical disabilities. And remember, these are women of childbearing age. 12.7%, that's actually a pretty large number when you think about it. And we were able to split this chronic physical disability group into three levels of severity that I won't go into based on how difficult were the functions that they self-identified. Okay, so our analysis used sociodemographic characteristics coming from the sample adult core and the family core. We used chi-square tests to test for bivariable associations, and then we conducted multivariable logistic regressions to predict current pregnancy. And our numbers of predictors, even though we had a huge sample, you know, 47,000 women, was limited by the number of women with chronic physical disabilities and the number of pregnancies. So we were able to adjust for these variables: the year of the data, the age group, race, ethnicity, marital status, income, and disability. Okay, results. All right, these are raw rates now, but they account for the sampling weights. So basically, if when you're using the NHIS, the National Health Interview Survey, you use sampling weights, you basically produce nationally representative numbers. Okay, so across all women, at a given random point in time, in a given year, 3.5% report that they're currently pregnant. And among women without current chronic physical disabilities, that's 3.8%. But among women with any chronic physical disability, it's 2%. And you can see on this slide that there's a steady gradation based on how severe the chronic physical disability is. Those with a minor disability is 2.6%. With a moderate disability, it's 1.8%, and a severe disability, it's 1.5%. So I'm not going to give you the adjusted odds ratios, but I'll just or the exact p-values for these bivariable associations. But you can just kind of understand from your basic understanding of sociodemographics that it's not so surprising that compared with women without chronic physical disabilities, women with chronic physical disabilities are likely to be older, black, less likely to be Asian, less likely to be Hispanic, actually, which is a complicated relationship, but here it's less likely, more likely to be divorced or separated, more likely to have less than a high school education, and less likely to have more than or at least a college education, less likely to live in households with children, less likely to be employed, more likely to live in poverty, and more likely to have health insurance and a usual source of care. Okay, multivariable logistic regression results. The adjusted odds ratio of a current pregnancy for women with chronic physical disabilities was 0.83. So just by looking at the odds ratio alone, they're 70% less likely than other women to have a current pregnancy. But if you look at the 95% confidence intervals around that, it includes one, And the p-statistic, p-value, is only 0.12. And so it's not a statistically significant finding. And so what this suggests is that if you adjust for the variables that we adjusted for, women with chronic physical disabilities have current pregnancy at the same rate as other women. Obviously, the main thing that we need to look at is what are the contributors to this, and it's age. So it's basically age and marital status that are the primary contributors to differences in the pregnancy rates between women with and without chronic physical disabilities. And it looks like, though, that the chronic disability does not contribute to the C value. It's really age and marital status that does. And the three chronic physical disability severity levels also were not significant. So, extrapolating from the NHIS results, there's about 8.3 million women who are non-institutionalized of childbearing age who have chronic physical disabilities, including 3 million with severe chronic physical disabilities. And about 163,000 of them are currently pregnant in the United States at any time. And about 44,000 of these who are pregnant have severe chronic physical disabilities. So the implications are that in terms of absolute numbers and percentages, women with chronic physical disabilities are less likely than other women to be currently pregnant. Nevertheless, there's quite a few of them who are. And especially since the numbers will rise in coming decades of the population of women with chronic physical disabilities, this is something that people need to actually think about. And so it's important that clinical and supportive services plan for pregnancy among women with chronic physical disabilities. Obviously, this study has important limitations, primarily relating to the data set. We only have that one question about current pregnancy, and we have no information about the pregnancy outcomes. All functional status information is self-reported, and so you have to take some caution, or the absolute numbers with some caution. But nonetheless, you know, the usual kind of researcher's conclusion that we need more research to understand the needs of women with chronic physical disability who are both planning pregnancy and who become pregnant. The needs are likely going to include not only clinical services, but also long-term services and supports in the community to assist them in raising their child. But in fact, doing this kind of in-depth research is probably going to be challenging because of small numbers of cases in local geographic areas. And in fact, in other parts of our study, we reviewed medical records at the Massachusetts General Hospital where I work, and we reviewed 100 records salted by looking first at records that were flagged by diagnosis codes that would make you think that the woman had a chronic physical disability, and we actually couldn't find any women. And so that's kind of a cautionary tale to us in terms of thinking about how we can do more research. Thank our funding source, and with this slide, and happy to take questions for all of us now who can come up to the table to do that, right, Shay?
That was all part of the training, yeah. In fact, I became a real expert in terms of wheelchairs and retracting arms and leg rests and everything else that we needed to do in order to get the wheelchair as close as to the machine as possible. So, yes, we did. And I have to tell you, one of the sites, we had such a wonderful technologist who really loved doing this work. And she left after the first year, but... yes, we did, and it was great.
It's been done a few years ago, a similar project with the Department of Public Health here, and what we found with the RAD techs were I mean, it was not like, you know, they really appreciated it, and it was something that was a real positive. And the other thing was actually trying to systematize the intake where they would include, the screeners using these extra time with positioning or something about the mobility staff coming in so they could have extra time. Like build an extra time in the system.
Right.
Which is difficult to do, but that was coming out. Of course, we don't know after we left if we continue to do that.
Can I just comment on
I just wanted to comment on your comment about the Affordable Care Act. It's Section 4203 of the Affordable Care Act that requires the government to come up with standards for accessibility of medical diagnostic equipment. And I just had the somewhat awkward pleasure of chairing the advisory committee for that actually is about to submit the final report to the U.S. Access Board. And mammography equipment was one of the equipments that obviously there was a lot of attention paid to. And they chose not to come up with standards for mammography access for scooter users because, in fact, it is somewhat difficult to think about how a scooter could approach the mammography equipment in a way that could allow a woman with a disability to actually use the equipment. Although people might have noticed me early in my presentation raise my scooter, and I can rotate and swivel the seat. But basically, you know, the standards that are going to come out will not address scooter use, but they are going to address chairs that people should transfer to that are mammography chairs. Okay. And so these standards, these recommendations for standards are going to be coming out of the U.S. Access Board. They'll be submitting a proposed rule for that will then have public comment. And so you're going to have to make sure to get your public comments in after that. But then the Department of Justice takes those, and that's when the long wait might happen. Okay, and so that's when, if anybody's into advocacy, that's when some advocacy might be needed, the long wait from the DOJ. Yeah.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Sure, I didn't really talk about this, but we had community agency partner sites in 21 counties across the state, and we essentially asked them to indicate if the woman, you know, what was her range of functioning and so forth, and we know that that's as far from perfect as you could probably get. Our aim with this study was initially was to test and then develop a modification of this intervention called Women Be Healthy. And so our aim was to get women in the study who had disabilities that would permit them to participate in the intervention. So women didn't have to be literate, few were, but they did have to be able to benefit from the program that we developed. And so that was the reasoning. We did not use IQ-based measures, which are deeply flawed in any case. And you know, our real question to the partner sites was, could the woman benefit? And if they felt that she couldn't, then she was not included. Although we did have some women with severe impairments, and they really did beautifully. And you know, the sample is too small, but. So we didn't have statistical significance because we were underpowered for them, but clinically, you know, their gains in knowledge were really impressive. So, you know, we think that this intervention is promising for a greater range of women than it was initially developed to target. But I think the other thing I want to say is that, you know, your comment is appropriate when you consider limitations of our findings. We're not presenting the range of access to PAP tests for all women with intellectual disabilities. These are women who live in community-based settings, not in institutions. These are women who, you know, generally are on the higher end of functioning. Okay.
And I just want to comment is we've done a lot of research using the same kind of methodology, and I just think it's really difficult to have both measures and to really articulate, you know, what the functioning level is of individuals with IDD.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a great comment. Absolutely.
For Dr. Baraldi, I work for one of the managed care organizations, medical assistance managed care organization in the state of Pennsylvania. We have about 330,000 people, either Medicaid or dual eligible Medicare. And we have a lot of women, obviously, that have disability, physical or intellectual disability. And one of the things I work on is breast cancer screening. And when you were talking about reimbursement, I mean, again, I work with a preventive health specialist. I'm not in, like, the enrollment or the claims or any of that area, but I have learned internally when I'm trying to roll out interventions that a lot of times you have to get to those reimbursement people early on, because they're the ones that are actually going to say yay or nay about changing a contract and all that kind of stuff. So I'm curious, when you talk about the reimbursement, do you work at all with those agencies? Because what I have seen happen on certain projects, and again, sometimes it takes a really stubborn, persistent person to be saying you need to change the reimbursement from $22 to $25, and whatever you have to change it to. So I know it would be a matter of, like, going individually, but have you thought about doing that versus trying to change the, like, system on kind of the state side?
We haven't really, no. I think we've just addressed it in terms of the overall policy change. And again, with limited resources, we haven't really been able to affect a change in that area so much. So basically, the women, it's Medicaid that's being, charged.
Yeah.
So, but, yeah.
Thank you for that. Thanks.
Thank you for these great presentations. It's good to know that there are other places besides Kansas where there are access issues. I'm just thinking about in my community, I just did a little survey, and not one general practitioner has a scale to rate people in wheelchairs. And I know from experience, don't argue with your provider, but you don't argue with dentists before they do your teeth because they have so much power. Whether you need a change on the wheelchair or anything. So, you know, we're looking for ways at the community level to educate, maybe for an independent living center, because you really can't do it as a patient often. I know in my provider, who's great because I've worked with her for a long time and I've trained her, when they moved into a new, huge, nice building, they referred to the two rooms with accessible tables as the Cadillac room. So it wasn't that they were needed, it's that they were a luxury to have. So I appreciate the work I've heard today, and there's so much to do in every community. But again, I think we need to do it in a way that the patient doesn't have to do it, because there's a lot of law out there.
I agree.
Right, that's why I said, once these standards go into place, that's when the Department of Justice will tell the practitioners, do you have to buy an adjustable weight or an accessible weight scale? And one of the little battles that we fought was actually about this, the dimension of the weight scale. Because weight scale for you, you've got kind of a square wheelchair. It's going to be very different than a weight scale for me with my long kind of scooter. And I'll tell a funny story. My hospital is kind of working with not necessarily on a voluntary basis, let's put it that way, with the local independent living, the CIL, Boston Center for Independent Living, on improving accessibility. And so they went out and they bought a bunch of square weight scales. And so a summer ago, I went to see my bone endocrinologist for my osteoporosis, and the young practice assistant came out just so smiling, "We're going to weigh you today." And he came in, and he brought me in to look at this square scale, and I looked at it, and I said, "Okay, I don't think this is going to work." And he said, "But yes, it will. It's a wheelchair scale. You know, we've got it for you." And I said, "Okay, well, I'm willing to kind of play with this." So I rolled onto the scale, and my front wheel was kind of hanging off the front. My back wheel was hanging off the back. And he said, he asked me how much my scooter weighed, you know, because it's going to subtract that from the weight of this that's shown on the scale to come up with my weight, what my weight is. And I told him, and then he said, "Oh, you weigh 200 pounds. Well, okay, folks. I don't actually think I weigh 200 pounds. But it actually was pretty difficult to convince him not to put this into the online medical record. Because if it had gotten into the medical record, it would never have been expunged. And everybody who saw me would have said, "Oh, but you weigh 200 pounds, right?" So I think that one of the pushbacks, though, that we heard from people in the audience at these Access Board hearings that we held in Washington was that the weight scales, the wheelchair accessible weight scales that are going to fit scooters are going to have a bigger footprint. And so if there's a small doctor's office, they're not going to want to buy the longer scales. And so this is where the next battles are going to be, I think, is in seeing whether, in fact, the DOJ is able to have some regulations that have some teeth.
This all came out of a policy think tank we developed.
from the program. Carol sits on it with me, and it was we had the Hudson Valley School of Nursing. We had people from Memorial Sloan Kettering, which is a large cancer treatment hospital, commissioner from people with disabilities, people from CMS, the state and our partners. And these are very informed by people. But anytime we approach any of them, including one woman who is a renowned GYN oncologist, who was the chair of the diversity program at the hospital, said, "Gee, I've never thought of this. My office isn't accessible." And the nursing school, "Oh my God, we never have anything in our curriculum." So this kind of thing we constantly up against. Gee, we never thought about that. And one of the most concerning things at this meeting was that I spent some time yesterday speaking to the public health schools. Oh God, there must be like 30, 40 of them in the exhibition area. And only two, one in Kansas actually. And I'm not with the other one that even addressing the issues of people with disability as a medically underserved at risk population. And yet, you know, we're all doing our little pieces all over, and yet there is no real organized effort to bring this to the attention of not only facilities, but the, you know, clinicians, technologists, policy makers. And it strikes me as if we could just kind of just have a forum where we can all share what we've been doing and try to get some attention on the national level to address these things, which are required by law. And it's an educational piece. And I really, you know, think that most people really would like to know more, like you said, about mammography machines, but unless we organize ourselves as educators and advocates, none of this is going to happen. So my question is there a way you could begin to talk about how we could coalesce to do this, you know, based on what our individuals' experiences, and bring it to some kind of national education, conference, publications, or whatever?
Yeah, I'm going to see you, let's say. My point is also coming
I'm sorry, I'm having a really hard time hearing you. Can you be a little louder? Sorry.
Okay, my name is Pauline Hatzoff, and we've been involved in the viewing texts of people with intellectual disabilities in England. And we found a very pervasive attitude about intellectual activity for people with intellectual disabilities. But that was not only from allies and caregivers, but it was also from medical professionals making assumptions about whether people should have near tests at all. And often based on inaccurate or no knowledge at all about previous sexual experience, whether that was voluntary or involuntary. And I was wondering if you developed any intentions or done any work with medical practitioners to try and address those attitudes.
Right. Well, first of all, I really appreciate the comment, because certainly our experience in the research has found that many of these women are sexually active without the knowledge of their caregivers, whether the caregivers are family member or whether the caregiver is paid. I ran residential programs in New York and New Jersey for, 10 years, and parents never wanted their daughters to be sexually active, and many actively believed they were not and were wrong all the time. So I think that this is one of the remaining taboos left from the eugenics era, and I think that on the paid side, residential providers really struggle with how do you manage the sexuality of the folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities that you're serving. And I know that many residential providers try to put in place means of controlling access to sexual expression. And, you know, we know that those are policies that fail constantly, frankly. And, you know, that was my experience as a service provider, and, you know, certainly it's borne out by the evidence in our research. I think that we certainly have seen situations where there's tacit agreement between the parent and the healthcare provider that the woman is not sexually active, when in fact she is. And, you know, I've worked with plenty of women with intellectual disabilities who were being sexually assaulted by a family member, which raises a whole other set of problems in terms of then parents often, if they're the perpetrator, they don't want the woman exposed to education because of fear of being discovered, and certainly had that experience as a care provider and in various work I've done with other states. So, you know, I think that this is one of those tip of the iceberg issues where, you know, 9/10 of it is something that our field is terribly uncomfortable with, doesn't want to talk about. We don't necessarily have effective sex ed. We can't necessarily even be confident that, you know, when we talk about coercion in this context, what do we even mean? Because many times these are women who very much want to be sexually active and, you know, are being controlled in some way by a care provider, whether family or paid, to ensure that it doesn't happen. And then they're being sexually assaulted by staff. So, you know, I think that this is an extremely complex issue. And I think that because a Pap test is so difficult to administer from, you know, to a woman who's not, you know, sort of fully understanding the procedure and really wanting to go along with it, you know, I think that physicians want to take the easy route out, which is say, she's not sexually active, we don't have to do it. And that has, none of my either research or practice experience suggests that's correct. So I think you're spot on that we need to educate physicians and other, you know, nurse practitioners, health providers who are doing these physical exams and bring them to the forefront. But you know, that is a very challenging undertaking for many of the reasons that Marilyn was talking about. So.
We have no idea. That's the problem. We have absolutely no idea. Yeah, but let me just say that it's not just women with intellectual and developmental disabilities for whom there's a huge stigma. A part of our project is also interviewing women with chronic physical disabilities who got pregnant. And I've had a number of them talk to me about how strangers have come up to them on the street and asked them if they were raped. You know, the assumption being that that's the only way that they could have gotten pregnant. I've actually had two women respond the exact same way to the following question. How did that happen to you? Quote, I had sex.
I was just thinking about your comment about collaborations and, you know, that there's something that can be done. And I'm sitting here, I think I'm probably the only person at ACHA who, from the NGO organization or in public health, so I feel a little alone, but we are out there. And I was thinking, when you were talking before about studying pregnancy, and actually maybe even getting back to your question, one of the things that I know the NGO organizations have is a plethora of data, I mean, specifically on our numbers, but I'm thinking of sort of unlikely partnerships. So if you have, like, a dual-eligible, you know, plan, and as you all know, with the CMS star rating, we're being really charged. Two of the things are cervical cancer screening and breast cancer screening. And so if you were trying to find, this doesn't really necessarily help you with pregnancy, but it could help some of you. If you're trying to find a population that you're having difficulty finding because of that one question, that's the only question, if you thought about maybe partnering with an organization that could kind of find women of childbearing age who have even like DME, around physical disability supplies. It wouldn't necessarily get you into intellectual disability, but you could take out other CPT codes where the woman had an injury and needed a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. So you might be able to find a population through kind of a strange partnership that you wouldn't typically think of kind of collaborating with.